Lenin, Trotsky, and the rest of Marxists were implacably opposed to terrorism. They waged a struggle against it. Eventually, they succeeded in convincing the students and winning them over on the basis that also that the working class began to move in Russia. In the 1960s in South America, particularly after the Cuban Revolution, this is very unfortunate. Of course, we are the firmest supporters of the Cuban Revolution. The Cuban Revolution was an enormous step forward, enormous advance of the struggle. But unfortunately, because of the lack of a Marxist, real, genuine Marxist leadership, a genuine Marxist party, the Cuban Revolution took the distorted form of guerrillaism. Although, by the way, even in Cuba, the proletariat of Havana played a very important role. They did a general strike at the end of it, which finished Batista off. But there were no Soviets, there was no workers' control and so on in Cuba. It was done by the guerrillas. Now, this was very good, but also very bad. Why do I say it's very bad? Well, very bad in the sense that people drew the wrong conclusions. People in South America drew the conclusion, well, this is the Cuban model. This is the way to go forward. This is the thing. You set up a guerrilla group among the peasants in the countryside and you carry out the revolution. Now, this was a disaster. The only reason why the Cuban Revolution succeeded in the way that it did was quite simply that they took the American imperialists by surprise. They weren't expecting this. Didn't know what to make of Castro. They were divided and out of the scene. And therefore they were taken off guard. That never happened again. Never happened. These guys also learned. The imperialists also learned. They studied the writings of not just of Marx and Lenin and Trotsky, but the writings of Che Guevara as well. They made a careful study. And they drew the necessary conclusion. And the conclusion was, the moment that the first foco, as they call it in Spanish, the focal point, was formed, the first nucleus was formed in the countryside, they would concentrate the repressive apparatus and crush it. That's what happened to Che Guevara, unfortunately. A man that I confess I underestimated Che Guevara in the past. I now think that the man was a very great revolution. He wasn't a fully developed Marxist, unfortunately. And he made a mistake. He paid with his life. And when I discussed the question of Che Guevara, I wrote an article on his anniversary. I raised this with Serge Goulart, who's now joined our international with his group in Brazil, who's leading the factory occupations of the Brazilian workers. He said the following, he said, look, Alan, I cannot forgive Che Guevara. Well, take your point, say what you like, but I can't forgive him because he's responsible for the deaths of thousands of young people in South America. I think that was a bit hard, a bit harsh of Serge to say that. But what he meant was that by pursuing this erroneous tactic, a mistake, Che also paid with his life. I will never understand why Che Guevara selected Bolivia. The idea that he had was correct, to extend the revolution throughout South America. He said the only way to save Cuba is by creating one, two, half a dozen, 10 Vietnams. The idea was correct. Unfortunately, he chose Bolivia again, which was a good choice. But why on earth, what a country to choose? You've got a strong working class with revolutionary traditions, with communist traditions, with Trotsky's traditions, as a matter of fact. He based himself on, not even on the peasants, but on the backward Indians. They couldn't even speak the language. They didn't even speak Spanish. And he was easily just, the man was paid with his life. But that model, that false model, was then imitated. What's even worse, these ultra-left in South America developed a new theory, nobody had ever heard of this, called urban guerrillaism. Now, guerrilla war would make sense, does make sense, in a backward peasant country such as China. There's a long history of peasant wars. The whole history of China for 2,000 years is dominated by peasant wars. But a country like Bolivia, with a powerful working class, with a revenue tradition in the towns, of course, it was foolishness. And even worse, in Argentina, there were groups in Argentina. There was a group called the ERP, the People's Revolutionary Army, who were supposed to be Trotskyists. They were Mandela, followers of Mandel. And what's really particularly disgusting is that Mandel, sitting on his ass in Paris, this academic, this intellectual, was applauding this and supporting it. We criticize it. That's one of the reasons we broke with the so-called Fourth International. We were expelled, actually, because we fundamentally opposed this. This madness, you said it was madness, it was madness. And it was encouraged by these individuals. disgusting, I mean, when you think about it. They weren't getting killed. They weren't putting their lives in danger, but they were encouraging these young kids. They conducted, let me give you one example to show what I mean. When I say, I'll say the following, it might sound peculiar. That the terrorism has its most negative results when it succeeds. That's the most negative results. Let me give you a case in point. There was a strike, I've forgotten the details of the strike, and it was a company owned by a German capitalist in Buenos Aires, I think, in Argentina, anyway. The strike had gone on for some time. The ERP intervened in this strike. They kidnapped the factory owner, the German capitalist. They held him for ransom. They held him hostage. And the conditions for releasing him was that they should, the bosses should capitulate to the workers' demands, give the workers what they wanted, distribute free blankets and food in the poor areas, and publish the manifesto of the ERP in the mass media. And they succeeded. This was done. Now, is this a good thing or a bad thing? The first reaction might be to say, well, it's a good thing. It's not. It's a thoroughly bad thing. And the reason that it's a thoroughly bad thing is this. What conclusion, you put yourself in the shoes of an Argentinian worker in this factory, what conclusion are you expecting to draw from this? The conclusion is quite clear. That in order to win a strike, it is not necessary to have a trade union, assemblies, workers' meetings, strikes and so on. All that you need is to take a gun and take a bomb and kidnap the boss and so on. In other words, you are lowering the class understanding of the problem. You're lowering the conception of organization. You're diluting the class level, you're not helping the workers at all. Apart from which, this is not the policy of Marx and Lenin, this is the policies of Robin Hood. I'm just recording Robin Hood now on the television. Good film. Errol Flynn, you know that one? You remember that film? Show your age, Harry. It's the policies of robbing the rich to help the poor. Now, that is not a genuine proletarian Marxist conception. It's not a question of nice people, nice educated students helping the poor. That's not the workers must understand through struggle, through education, through organization, that they themselves must change society. Nobody else must change society for them. If you have the conception that somebody else is going to do the work, then that if it were to succeed in changing society, that would automatically lead to a bureaucratic regime in which the workers would be excluded from power. You've rest assured of it. Rest assured of it. And guerrillaism, Cuba's an example of that actually, where the guerrillas come to power, you automatically have a bureaucratic regime. Apart from anything else, the structure of the guerrillas, the military structure, is completely undemocratic. It's an army. You do as you're told. You follow orders or you get shot. Or something unpleasant will happen to you. And therefore the whole conception is alien to the Marxists. It's alien to the idea, for example, of the Russian Revolution, based on the working class taking power, on the basis of the Soviets with workers' control and genuine democracy. It's an entirely different model. In any case, 99 times out of 100, it will not succeed. 99 times out of 100, it will fail. Not only will it fail, but it will strengthen reaction, as happened in Argentina. All right, you might succeed once or twice in getting away with a stunt like that. You know what will happen after that. The ruling class in Argentina draws the conclusion, okay, girls and boys, you want to play hardball? You play hardball with us. We know how to do terrorism as well. We will terrorize you. Which is precisely what happened. You had a coup d'etat, and thousands of people, I've forgotten how many people, nobody knows how many people were killed, tortured, disappeared, turned up in the river, in the sea with their hands and feet cut off. To this day they counted the victims. And it set the whole movement back. It set it back 20 years. That's the result of terrorism in Argentina. There was a particularly tragic case. There was another movement that Ted thought a lot of. It was very appreciative. Within the Peronism was a mass movement, very contradictory movement, with a right wing which veered towards fascism and a left wing which veered towards ultra-leftism, actually. The Montoneros and the Peronist youth, who had guns, by the way, hundreds of thousands of working class youth were armed. If they'd have been equipped with Marxist policy to win over the working class, to take power by the means that we would advocate, the history of Argentina would have been entirely different. But they also eventually, unfortunately, went down the same road of individual terrorism. And let's be clear, think about it. Think about it. I mean, Trotsky once said, when all else fails, when you have no other alternative, start to think. That's not a bad idea. How can any group overthrow the bourgeois state by such means? If you can enter into a military competition, a competition about who can win militarily, you will never succeed. The only way in which you can defeat the might of the bourgeois state is through mass struggle, as they've shown in Russia, where they overthrew the most powerful military state on earth. You have to win over the soldiers by political means. So that just led to one disaster after another. I touched on the situation in the Middle East, in Palestine, which is a tragedy. I can't go into that in detail. The Palestinian people, the Palestinians, the PLO, could have played a very positive role. They had all everything in their favour. because of the dispersal of their people all over the Arab world in particular. By the way, the Palestinians originally, up until very recently, didn't have any trace of Islamic ideology. The Palestinians were called themselves socialists. They're progressive and they were not religious at all. And you're all the possibility. Unfortunately, the PLO, Arafat, went down the same road of so-called armed struggle. It wasn't armed struggle at all. What armed struggle? It was a crazy thing. Planting bombs and suicide missiles, capturing airplanes. What did it achieve? All that it achieved was to drive the Israeli people behind the reactionary Zionist state. It helped the reactionary Zionist state. I remember there was a discussion. Actually, people from the PLO came to London about 1970, I think. And they had this, I wasn't present, but they discussed with Ted, and he said, now look, why didn't you forget all this madness, all this nonsense about individual terrorism? Why didn't you base yourself on the masses in the West Bank, the occupied West Bank, and prepare for a mass resistance against Israeli imperialism? Oh no, it's impossible, can't be done. The Israeli state, the Israelis are too powerful and so on. They didn't do it. Now, they were entirely false. They were shown to be false by the Intifada, the first Intifada. What was the date of that? 1987? 87, yes. We predicted that. There's a mass uprising of the people. But what was tragic, and by the way, that had an effect in Israel, had a big effect in Israel. There were cases of soldiers, Israeli soldiers, refusing to fight and deserting and breaking down in tears because they didn't want to fight against ordinary people. It had a big effect inside Israel. It provoked a big opposition. That was the way to proceed. The tragedy was, you had these people, they rose up with their bare hands, armed with sticks and stones, against tanks. Now what they should have done, that's why I say we're not pacifists. If the PLO had been serious about armed struggle, what they ought to have done for a period of 10 or 20 years is gradually to infiltrate arms into the West Bank, into every village and every town, small groups of fighters, not more than 10 or a dozen in each area, such that when there was a mass uprising, when the conditions were right, the masses would be armed. And that would have been a powerful thing. That could have succeeded, in my opinion. They weren't armed, and therefore they were eventually crushed. They were crushed by the Israeli state. And by the way, the PLO played no role. It makes me sick, frankly. It makes me sick. People like Arafat and Mandela and all these people talking big. I won't go into the history of the PLO. They played a pernicious role. It led to one bloody defeat after the other of the Palestinians. In Jordan in 1970, Black September, they were massacred not by Israelis, by Arabs. By King Hussein, supposed to be their friend, some friend. They were driven out of Jordan. They then ended up in Lebanon, where they upset the very delicate balance. And contributed to a bloody civil war. They ended up driven out of the Lebanon. They ended up in Tripoli. Well, not Tripoli. It was at Tunisia. Tunis. Sitting on their ass and drinking cups of coffee and talking about armed struggle where the people were suffering. They did nothing. Absolutely nothing. They played no role in the Intifada. But of course, when eventually the imperialists moved for pressure on the Israelis to do a deal, They did what all these terrorists have always done. I repeat, liberals with bombs, that's what they are. They turn up, I better be careful about choosing my words carefully, with these pot-pitted, very middle-class men. I've been on a diet. guess you haven't noticed. But I'm not objecting to me using this simile, but I'll use it anyway. These pot-bellied, corrupt old gangsters coming in for Tripoli with their khaki uniform. It's just a joke. And of course, immediately taking control of everything. They're taking control of the state, excluding the masses. And they're as corrupt as hell, including Arafat, by the way. Can't say that now because he's like a saint now because he's dead. But he also filled his pockets. They were all filling their pockets and repressing people. With the result, you get this development of Hamas, which is a very negative thing. The development of Islamic fundamentalism, in effect, which is a negative thing. It shows desperation, as a matter. And terrorism also is an expression of desperation. It leads nowhere. You think that the Israelis are worried about Hamas? They're not worried about Hamas. Yossi Sfat tried to say, oh, they were driven out of Gaza. They were not driven out of Gaza by anybody. They deliberately withdrew from Gaza in order to tighten their control on the West Bank, because they're not interested in Gaza, which is nothing. They're interested in the West Bank. And by God, they consolidated the position on the West Bank. And all that this terrorism is doing, I repeat, is assisting the Zionists and assisting Israel. It's creating the idea, oh, these Arabs want to murder us all. Even left-wing, even progressive people think that. They want to kill us. Every time a bomb explodes, a suicide bomb explodes on a bus or in a marketplace, what conclusion do you think people are drawing? Oh, they want our blood, they want to kill us. We must close ranks. This is fatal for the Palestinians. The only way that the Palestinians can succeed, of course, we support the Palestinians' right to self-determination. Of course, the people of Israel also must have the right to self-determination. They must have somewhere to live. And therefore, it can only be done on the basis of socialist policies, class policies. By dividing the Jewish state or the Israeli state on the basis of class revolutionary politics, there's no other solution. Otherwise, it's just a nightmare. And in general, of course, when we get to the stage of groups like Al Qaeda, what does it expect? This is a particularly repugnant form. Well, I did mention Ireland, of course. That's another example. We were the only Marxist group in the world, particularly in Britain, that took a firm position in relation to the IRA campaign, the provisional IRA. We are on the question of Irish unification, we are in favour of Irish unification. The division of Ireland, the partition of Ireland, was a crime of British imperialism, the same as the partition of India and all the other crimes of British imperialism. Of course we're in favour of a united Ireland. The question is, how do you achieve it? That's the point. I won't go into the history of Ireland or the history of the recent events. It's not necessary. We've written on this many times. And it's a subject in and of itself. It's too long to deal with in the small amount of time which is left to me. Just to say this, we were the only group that implacably opposed the terrorist campaign of the IRA. All the other so-called left groups supported it. Oh, incidentally, we were also the only tendency, let's remind people of this, in 1969, that opposed the sending of British troops to Ireland, to the north of Ireland. The SWP supported the sending of the British army to Ireland on the grounds that they were going to defend the Catholics, if you please. Mind you, many Catholics thought that. Even the IRA thought that. This is why they didn't oppose originally. We explained, we said, we moved a motion in the Labour Party conference. But if British troops are sent to the north of Ireland, it would not be to defend the Catholics, but on the contrary, it would be to defend the interests of British imperialism. All the others capitulated, the Morning Star, the Communist Party, the SWP, all were supporting. And then the following day, they did a 180-degree leap over our heads and started the so-called Troops South movement. Troops South movement. And they actually defended the IRA. We refused to criticise the bombing and so on. We took an implacable position. We said, we said to the Irish Republicans, my friends, this is not the way. As a result of this, 30 years later, isn't it? It is, my God, it's 30 years later. 30 years later. We are the only tendency that gets an echo in Ireland among the left-wing Republicans. It's a fact. We don't want to know about the SWP. We don't want to know about anybody else. They take us seriously. Why do they take us seriously? Precisely because we took a firm position in relation to terrorism, and our position was shown to be correct. And it's a tragedy, it's a terrible tragedy. 30 years later, 3,000 dead, and many of them were good young kids, good young potential revolutionaries, were killed and sent to prison, families were wrecked, lives were wrecked. What's the result? Tegnan asked this question, I think he asked it to one of the leaders, I think it was Martin McGuinness, at the Labour Party conference some years ago. He was invited to speak at a fringe meeting of the Labour there. And Tegnan asked McGuinness a question. He said, what's the result after 30 years of so-called armed struggle? 3,000 people have been killed. Whole communities have been wrecked. You have split the working class right down the middle. The bitterness is even greater between Protestant and Catholics than what it was before. And Irish unification is not in sight. You've forgotten about Irish unity. They've dropped it. That's what you've achieved. And to Ted's astonishment, McGuinness didn't disagree with him. How could he disagree? He admitted it. He said, yes, well, we made a mistake, some mistake, because they forgot the basic class position on the Irish question, which was put forward by Connolly, which has been defended by our organisation. And what's the result of this? They all put their suits on. And now Martin McGuinness and Adams are sitting at the same, members of the same government as Ian Paisley, the Protestant reaction. That's the result of 30 years of terrorism. And the sects, what have they got to say? They haven't got anything to say. Keep stum, don't say anything. They've got no position. How can they say? What's their position on the Good Friday Agreement? If they oppose the Good Friday Agreement, then they've got to oppose Martin McGuinness that they've supported for the last 30 years. In other words, having betrayed the movement, having betrayed, never mind about the working class, having betrayed the Irish national struggle, because they've forgotten all about Irish unification, where is it mentioned? The unification of Ireland, nothing, it's been forgotten. That was supposed to be the intention. That was the aim of the whole damn thing. Having done that, they take plum ministerial jobs, briefcase under their arm, liberals with bombs, and they were always liberals with bombs and nothing else, with a disastrous result. Same thing in South Africa. You know, I went to university many years ago. In 1963, I went to Sussex University, and I was in the university with Thabo Mbeki. Didn't like me because I won all his group over for the militant. He was left up the creek without a paddle, as they say, left on his own. He's now the president of South Africa with his suit and his tie. His old man was in prison for many years in Govan Island. But he's there, and he's completely betrayed everything. The ANC. All this stuff, armed struggle, the glories of, again, where, when? When was there armed struggle against the apartheid regime? Never. The apartheid regime was destroyed, was really put in difficulties by the movement of the black workers. The foundation of COSATU, the mass trade union, the mass strikes of the miners, that's what put them in. If it's not this so-called armed struggle, which is just a joke. And now all these so-called leaders who are in exile, very comfortable exile, by the way, in Britain, in Moscow, in East Berlin, they're now millionaires. Cyril Ramaphosa. There's a particular scandal because he was a miners, he was a workers' leader. He's now a millionaire. And a bourgeois. That's where these great terrorists end up. And it's a law. It's a law in every single case. And it's not an accident, if you understand the Marxist analysis. It's not an accident. Now, finally, I made the point earlier that the kind of terrorism was always wrong. It was wrong in Marx's day. Look, Marx was a great champion of the Irish people. Great champion of the Irish national struggle. He was a great friend of the Fenian movement. The Fenians were, in a way, they were like a terrorist movement, representing the poor peasants. A revolutionary democratic movement. But when the Fenians planted a couple of bombs in London, and by the way, this was a very small incident compared to the bombing campaign of the IRA. It's a minor thing. Clerkenwell. They killed a couple of people and so on. We published Marx's letter. Marx wrote to Engels condemning this outright. This is crazy. It's crazy, particularly because it will drive the English workers are reasonably friendly towards the Irish. It will drive them into the hands of the British and the English. That was Marx's position. Even in 1867, I think it was. Mick will correct me. 67, I believe. Yes, but that's nothing. That's compared to the monstrosity of today. I mean, how can anyone from a working class point of view justify, for example, the 11th of September? It's the 11th of September. I got the date wrong, didn't I? Was it the 11th or the 9th? The 11th. The 11th, I got my. Not very good at sons. The 11th of September, I should remember. How could you defend this? In what part? And we immediately reacted the very next, the same day, never mind about the next, the same day I wrote an article. So Jordy wanted me to wait for the next day. I said, no, we'll take a position now. I'm not even sure to this day, I'm not sure that the CIA was not involved in that. My reading on it, and I'm not convinced that that wasn't correct, my reading on that was that the CIA wanted some kind of terrorist incident in order to justify the strengthening of the state and all the rest of it, the invasion of Iraq and so on. But I think it went too far, because they weren't expecting that. That's too much. It escaped the control. That's my reading. That's what I thought at the time, and I think it's possible. It doesn't matter anyway whether it's true or false. It doesn't make any difference. The fact of the matter is that the 9th of September was a monstrous reactionary act. Unfortunately, I've met some people in Spain, in particular, Stalinists in particular, who cheered it. They thought it was a good thing. Why? Because American people are being killed. These ordinary American people. Working class people, office workers and so on, cleaners. This is a good thing. Well, some of them thought it was quite amusing. I said, you're entirely wrong. That's entirely false position. And the effects of this will be completely counter-revolutionary, and that's a fact. The effect, we said that also at the time, the effects, of, no matter who's behind it or what the reason, it doesn't matter, the effect of this will be completely counter-revolutionary, and by God, we were right. It justified the invasion of Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, all the other measures, the restriction of democratic rights. Every reactionary measure now is justified by terrorism in Britain also. In Britain, which was a relatively democratic country, they're taking away democratic rights. Now they wanted to hold people, I don't know for how long, without trial. In the past, there had been an uproar. If there's any suggestion to limit democratic rights in Britain. Now people accept it. Why do people accept it? Because of the monstrous role of individual terrorists. That's why they accept it. And therefore, there's not an atom of anything progressive in any of this. And to their shame, I don't think they have it, I don't think they're capable of shame. The British SWP thinks this is a good thing. They support Islamic fundamentalism. They support Islamic fundamentalism, not just in the Arab world, but in Indonesia, in Malaysia. It plays an extremely reactionary role. We must combat it. I mean, I accept that there are many poor people, ignorant people, that fall into the influence of the fundamentalists, because the socialists and communists in place in Indonesia have been incapable of offering them anything better. Some poor people fall into this trap, but it is a trap. In Indonesia, we will never build anything serious unless we combat the terrible influence of Islamic fundamentalism. That doesn't mean to say to attack Islam, of course. You don't attack Islam, you don't attack religion. But fundamentalism and terrorism is a different question. And therefore it's played a completely reactionary role. It still plays a reactionary role. What is the solution? Well, there is a solution. In the Middle East, for the whole of the last period, there's been this, incidentally, who organized the Islamic, who's responsible for Islamic fundamentalism? Precisely, the CIA. Deliberately organized. They were nothing. They deliberately helped the things like the Muslim Brotherhood and so on and so forth. They deliberately, Bin Laden, particularly in Afghanistan, against the Russians, against the progressive regime in Kabul. The Americans organized this deliberately. It's extreme reaction. I mean, to confuse, how the hell can you confuse revolution and reaction? It's a small mistake, Mick, you know. A slight mistake of our friends in the SWP to confuse revolution and counter-revolution. Goodness gracious me. It's extreme counter-revolutionary movements everywhere. In Pakistan, the communists have combated this with some effect, but ultimately in Pakistan there'll be a struggle between us and them. In Indonesia also there'll be a struggle between the Marxists, the communists, the labor movement, and this reactionary force, which was created by imperialism, but it escaped control. Like a mad dog, you know, a mad dog. Very dangerous to feed a mad dog. And you think that you've tamed it, you know, you give it biscuits and give it meat, raw meat in particular, you know, you think it's funny, you think it's amusing. You think it'll frighten your neighbours, well, it might frighten your neighbours, but if it's sufficiently mad, you know what happens eventually. it will bite you. And that's what happened to the Americans. They created this monster. And now the monster's turned against it. They can't control it. The only way to solve this, I'll finish on this because my time is up. The only way to tackle this madness of terrorism, which at basis, what it shows is despair. There's elements of despair. And the real cause of it is this. You want to know who's really responsible for individual terrorism, fundamentalism, so it's Stalinism and reformism. The Stalinists had a big influence, the Communist parties had a big influence in the Middle East in the 1950s and 60s. In Iraq, for example, the Iraqi Communist Party was a big party. They had a meeting of 1 million people, I think, in Khartoum. Not Khartoum, in Baghdad, in Baghdad. And of course they had the two-stage policy. They supported the so-called progressive bourgeois. Therefore, then you had the dictatorship of Colonel Qasim, who promptly put them all in jail. And similar thing happened in Indonesia, actually. The Indonesian Communist Party is a separate subject. But it was the biggest Communist Party in the world outside the Eastern Bloc. 3 million members. 10 million organized workers in the unions. And they claimed 40% of the army that was starting. Lenin could never claim that. They had an enormous, they had every chance of taking power. They didn't take power because they had the idea that Sukarno was a progressive bourgeois, that it was a progressive regime. The result we saw, terrible result. Same in Iraq, same in the Sudan. In the Sudan, they had a meeting of 3 million people in 1967. They supported Nimeiri, who became a dictator, and of course he suppressed it. As a result of the crimes of Stalinism, you get the frustrations of the youth, because the problems are still there. Terrible, but there's no alternative, that's the problem. There's no alternative. Same in Indonesia, there's no real alternative, you see. And therefore sections of the youth in desperation turn towards this madness. The only way to combat that is by building a serious, revolutionary Marxist party in Indonesia, the Middle East, and so on, with roots in the masses, with roots in the working class, based on our policy, the policies of Marx, of Engels, of Lenin, of Trotsky, and of this international. And that's beginning, just as a PS. In the Middle East, it's not given any publicity. They publish the bombings and the terrorism. They don't publish the mass strikes in Egypt. They don't publish the strike wave in Iran. And I think there's a revolutionary development taking place in Iran. They don't publish other strikes that have taken place in the Lebanon, in Jordan, in Morocco. In other words, the working class is beginning to move. We base ourselves on that movement. That's our hope. That's the only hope for the future, is the movement of the working class to change society and to take power into its own hands. Thank you, Governor.
Thanks for that, Alan. We've got about 20 minutes now for questions and discussion, and then for Alan to conclude.